You gotta move, you got to move. Oh, you gotta move, baby, you got to move. If you keep on mistreating me, baby, you got to move. I said, you gotta move, you got to move. Move on, oh, you got to move. If you keep on dogging me, baby, you got to move. My mother told me long time ago, watch out for women, oh, they can hurt your soul. And if you keep on hurting me like you do, and you gotta move. I said, you gotta move, you gotta move. Move on, oh, you gotta move. Now if you keep on dogging me around, you gotta move. Keep on mistreating me, oh, we got to part. I hate to let you go, baby, but oh, you got to move. Let me tell you one.
That's the great Sam Cooke with You Gotta Move. It's this classic from the 1963 album, Night Beat. This is Lead Stories. I'm your Trace Lead. It is Friday, November the 14th. And you know, what is interesting is that song was about, of course, a personal relationship. But in so many ways, it applies to our condition today, our condition with respect to our relationship with the political system, our condition with respect to how it is we're supposed to be functioning in this time, at this time, in this country, and outside of it. You know, just a whole bunch of things are coming together where people are feeling disfranchised and betrayed and let down by the relationships they thought they had with various systems. But in any event, this is Free Your Night, Free Your Mind Friday. My gosh. I need to get some ginkgo biloba to get some ginkgo biloba, blah, 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 blah. But I'm amazed. I'm amazed about where we are. And the more I talk about it, the more amazing it is that we can't seem to find our way out. What is happening here? But anyway, it's your turn. Free Your Mind Friday here on Lead Stories, 888-874-4888. Give us a call and share your thoughts about the issues of the day. You know, what I'd like you to do is actually engage us. Give us not just your opinion, but give us your analysis, which is very important to help us gain new perspective, new ground on what it is we are confronting. If you can do that today, that would be great. Just add that piece to your contribution as you call 888-874-4888. As we know, the city of Ferguson, all eyes are on Ferguson, waiting for the grand jury's decision. This might be the day, we don't know, but we expect that the grand jury's decision will be announced any day now. More than enough indication that it is soon, and we are seeing, you know, there too, a major, major issue about relationships with systems breaking down almost thoroughly. But anyway, I'm not going to say anything more. Let's get on to with your phone calls. 888-874-4888. From Berkeley, Harvey, you're on the air.
Hello, wonderful Utrice.
Hello, Harvey. How are you?
Very good, thank you, and glad to hear you. I'd like to give you another reason to say no to the XL pipeline, and give you an analysis or my analysis of the situation. The XL pipeline will produce carbon, and carbon. It turns out that global warming has turned into global baking, and every year it's the hottest year on record. And like up in Canada, the XL pipeline. They've tapped into the Canadian arboreal sands, the tar sands of Canada, and destroyed a large portion of Canada's arboreal forests, which are the lungs of the world. And here in California, because of global baking, there's more frequent and larger forest fires in California. But the real clincher, the scary one, is that in Brazil, São Paulo, Brazil, what they've done is the rainforest, they've slashed and burned, clear-cutted the rainforest to make way for commercial entities like growing palm oil and cattle for a world market. And by doing that, it turns out that rainforest, as well as other forests, create a lot of evaporation above the surface, and that creates clouds. And these clouds were called flying rivers. They would go towards San Paulo, and they would bring the water to fill the reservoirs, to run the hydroelectric dams, and for the city of 9 million people to have enough water to eat, to drink and bathe and everything that takes water, business. And now, due to them cutting down the Amazon rainforest or large portions of it, these flying rivers have stopped. And there's no more water. The reservoirs are drying up. If you go to Google, put in the word São Paulo, Brazil, drought, and there's a lot of articles. You can press the news button, and it'll bring up all the articles. It's really terrible. So these are the results. These are the results of short-term thinking, where we're devastating our forests worldwide. And here, where are 9 million people and their pets going to go? If you turn on the tap and there's no water, if you go to the bathroom and there's no water, I mean, this is tragedy. This is unbelievable. And so we have to rethink our approach to the planet. And I call for the mass replanting of our forests, our urban, suburban, recreational, federal, national forests, because we're losing it, you know, especially in California. The forest fires are getting bigger and bigger and stronger, because it's just hotter and hotter. So it's a water issue. So this is the justification I have for just saying no to the XL pipeline, because the XL pipeline will deliver more carbon into the atmosphere, and the world will just get hotter and hotter, and we'll have our own Brazil problem here. I mean, we have a drought in California already. I mean, it's a problem. There are lots of communities that the wells have run dry. This is the first time they've ever experienced it. So I'm calling for just say no to the XL pipeline and replant our national, and replant our forests.
All right. Well, thank you very much for that. From Dallas, Sarah, you on the air.
Well, is something going on over there? You too? I'm hearing an echo.
Oh, okay. I'm hearing you just fine.
Okay, well, greetings to you, Utrecht, and greetings to the PRN listening audience.
Thank you, and to you too, Sarah. What have you to say today?
Well, Utrecht, I don't know what y'all did down there in Florida, but it's been in the 30s up here in Dallas, and I'm ready to pack my bags and head on down your way, because I did not bargain for that cold spell. I thought I left that all on the East Coast when we moved forward to West, but the strange weather we've been having. But your topic that you were speaking on, you choose to free my mind on today, and in regards to this situation with the global warming and whatever else that, you know, Harvey was mentioning about what's going on, which ties into your piece that you had on Veterans Day when you played that piece by that young man, Veterans for Peace, I believe it was, that he was a participant of and was speaking about his time in the military and, you know, what he's trying to do right to make amends.
Vince Emanuele, and Veterans of Iraq War, Veterans Against the Iraq War, sorry.
Yes, and you know, what he's trying to do now to make amends for what he has done. And I have to commend the young man because, Utrecht, I do not celebrate any holidays. I don't celebrate none of it because I see there's not a thing for me to be celebratory about. I do not even acknowledge my born day because, to me, I had no part in being put here. So why should I be out celebrating something that it was not up to me? My parents are the ones who are responsible for me being put on this earth. So if they were alive today and they wanted to acknowledge it and celebrate it, then that's fine. They can do that. But if with any other things, I don't. To get back to the military topic, the military, and I could speak as someone who has worked as a mortuary casualty affairs officer, and if you have seen the things that soldiers have done to themselves and to others using a weapon, then you would change your point of view very, very quickly. I don't like for people to acknowledge me and they say it's okay, Happy Veterans Day, because as you said, they'd only choose this one time to come up with this phony nonsense and say, oh, you're a veteran, you know, thank you for your service. To me, I don't even acknowledge them. I just don't say nothing. Sometimes it pisses me off, and I said, there is nothing to thank me for. I said, because what I did, it was just a job. I didn't just do it because I was patriotic, which is why most of these people went out here to do it. It's because it was their job that went out there to do. But as the young man says, the United States government would prefer it's much cheaper for them to have someone die on active duty in a combat situation. Therefore, they can write your family that indemnity, that one-time death benefit, and be rid of you. If you have a veteran that comes back and have a 50 to 100% disability, that you have to pay them something every month, you have to take care of them medically, it's not cost effective for them. That is why they really and truly don't care about these veterans, and that is why, for me, I would tell anyone if they can get insurance, don't even go anywhere near these VA hospitals because you get the very worst kind of treatment that you can possibly get in these. And I'm speaking as someone who have used the medical facilities on active duty, and I've seen what the type of treatment that you got on active duty. And I know definitely I would never go and try and use the VA system because you get the bottom tier. That's what you are getting. And for these people to run around here, and especially these congressional people, and then you have a president who is the commander-in-chief who has never done any military service. This is three commanders-in-chief that you have had and possibly is going to be a fourth one who has never served on active duty in the military, from Bill Clinton, George Bush, as well as Barack Obama. They have never served active duty, but these are the people who are making a decision to put troops on the ground to go out here and fight these corporate wars. Because that is what you're out here doing. You're out here fighting for a corporation in order to take resources from other people in order to give it to the for the United States and the Western powers to consolidate and to have. You're not.
So I have to ask you then, what is the solution that you're offering?
The solution I would have to offer to people is to decline service. As the young man said, he refused to go. He told them what his bottom line was, is that, hey, you have one or three choices. You can either discharge me, you can put me in the brig, or I can go ballistic and I can take out a few people in here. And, you know, they already don't know that they have trained a killer. Because that's your main focus. When you are trained in the military, your first primary job is a killer. That's what they train you for. That's why your first 6 to 8 weeks, you are trained on various forms of weapons because you are trained to kill, and then before you go on to your secondary specialty, which is whatever you're going to specialize in. So you are a trained killer. So all of these people that they have running around out here, and I've told them over and over again, what you can do is to refuse service. That is why we have told our children, I said, I would prefer that you do not serve in the military. Do not go into the military because I don't see a point in you going to serve a corporation that when you get out, they really and truly don't give a darn about you. As he said, the amount of homelessness I've seen you treat with homeless veterans, people who are underemployed, it's these same people who are out here that they said that they're so proud of and they want them to put on the uniform and go and march like tin soldiers for them. But when they come back, they can't have a job, they don't have a home, they don't have food. You see, I go to a lot of these veteran centers to volunteer my time, and I've seen veterans usually just carrying their stuff in a bag, and they come into these centers during the day just so they could get the warmth and get some free coffee, water, use the facilities. And then when the centers close at 4:30 or whatever, they're back on the street, you know, looking for somewhere else warm that they can get into. This is how they treat these people.
Well, thank you for bringing that to our attention today. Thank you so much for your calls, Sarah. From Philadelphia, Clara, you're on the air.
Hello, Utrecht, and hello, fellow listeners.
Thank you.
Okay. I'm going to start by really reacting somewhat to what Sarah just said. I had some thoughts because I was a therapist when I was in the workforce, and I still think the same way I did then. When a client would come into my office and present the problems, I would listen, and then I would ask, how would you like things to be different? And then my third question would be, what do you think you can do to make that happen? And usually they were there because they didn't know. And I would say the focus of our work will be helping you to get to the point of realizing what you can do and how you can resolve it. And I think a lot about, of course, I want to say I agree with what you said about the veterans not serving. It's really the point of what I'm involved in. It's about, as I say, I mention it so many times, the personal responsibility and self-reliance part of dealing with this terror that we're experiencing at this time. We have so many things that we have to resolve. I mean, we're overwhelmed. I have a list here, just the general list, state terrorism, wars that are non-ending, the assault on our environment, the poisoning of our food, the climate changes. And we talk about these things, but they seem so unresolvable, unchangeable, because there's so many and they're so entrenched. But there's one thing that I think I find very worthwhile and very effective, and that is focusing on what can I do to change, to improve my own well-being and the well-being of those in my environment. It has to do with continuing to educate yourself so you know what to do and you know what's available, being always thoughtful about what you're doing, being consistent. And that's in the areas of food, health, the environment, and politics. And I think most of what we do to help ourselves has a negative effect on the system. And I want to give you an example. When we refuse to buy poisoned food, and I'm talking about food that's genetically engineered or prepared in an unsanitary way, we affect negatively the income of those people who put it out. When we refuse to allow ourselves to be chronically ill, and that's possible, then we cut the gross national product. That health system is one of the biggest areas of gross national product. I wanted to say the biggest areas of profit. When we use our cars very sparingly, or don't have a car. That's another area of where we help ourselves by keeping the money in our pockets and cut the profits of the people who are providing this. When we don't vote for people who have no interest in us whatsoever, we empower ourselves to think about other solutions, and we fail to give those people the legitimacy that they do not deserve. I'm just saying these are things, the only thing I haven't done, I mean, many things I haven't done, the thing that I'm working on that I haven't done that I know is extremely important is to give up meat. That's very important. I haven't been able to do it. So I'm not saying everything else I've been able to do so other people can. It's not easy. I'm just saying, unless we do those things, I don't think we will be able to succeed in our survival. As you said yesterday, and you and your guest, who was both of you were superb, I think, in your discussion, everything he said was true in my opinion. And you said also, we're facing some devastating times. And if we don't have our health and our wits about us, we'll all go down.
Thank you, Clara.
I have one more. I just have a quick question. May I ask you this? I want to contribute, but I don't know how to, is there someone I can call to get the address to send money in? I don't use PayPal. Maybe that you can find out and somebody can tell me. I'll just mail a check. I've been thinking that I was contributing. When I made a contribution a year ago, I thought they were taking it out of my American Express account, but they weren't.
Well, why not stay on? The engineer will take your call and give you some information. Just hold on, and he'll get to you right away. And thank you for that, by the way. That was a very generous of offer of yours. Thank you so much. From New York City, Ma'at, you're on the air.
Yes. Hi. Good day,
Teresa,
and to the PRN family. I want to respond to your question, and then I want to I have a couple questions for you. First, I want to say, in terms of just seeing everything go to hell in a handbasket, in a manner of speaking, I think that what we need to see that's clearly in front of us is the fact that for a long time now, perhaps definitely since the JFK assassination, is that we're dealing with a permanent shadow government. And you had on a guest, Professor Lance DeHaven Smith, I think the name of his book is Conspiracy Theory in America, and his SCAD program, State Crimes Against Democracy. I think he understands that we can't take things at face value. And, you know, the Eastern philosophies talk about Maya, appearances, illusions, so nothing is what it seems. His colleague, James Tracy, who I brought on a particular radio show, was dealing with and had very closely looked at Sandy Hook and the extreme anomalies in terms of the official story, so-called 9/11 at Al. Yes, Virginia, there is something. They call themselves the Council of the Illuminati. Others call them the globalists, et cetera, et cetera. I'd like to get on two things. First of all, I have some... what seemed to be success when I was sure that it was lead stories, plural, and sent it with just that one email. So it seems like it went through and it didn't bounce back as previously. I know you must have tons of email there, but do you recall, have you had a chance to get to your email? I'm trying to figure out whether
it
is.
Yes, I have. Yes, I have.
Excellent. Thank you so much. And, Eutrice, I'd like to get your thoughts about, I'm on edge with this situation in Ferguson. I think that on a certain level, my people have seen, especially I think the youth, you know, there's an, Gerald Celente says it perfectly. He says, when people have nothing to lose, they tend to lose it. And so I did hear somebody speak to having some kind of a forum in New York, in the city, I think this evening. I was, you know, half asleep listening, but, and they're, you know, doing trainings in nonviolence and civil disobedience. But I would like to get even your crystal ball take on what you think might be coming down the pike, and with this overall situation, because this situation in New York City that Bratton and de Blasio have come forth saying that now I guess they're going to racially select us for their summons, which is summonses, and we must have ID when we step into the street, and so that's going to be churned into a piece where certain people will be going to court and getting warrants and going through the system behind $100 and then the second time $250 dollar signs. And when you get a chance, also reflect on Al Sharpton letting go his Rubenstein guy behind the, what seems to be a rape. I haven't spoken, heard you speak on that. Now listen over the air. Appreciate you and your listeners.
Thank you. Well, I pretty much said quite early that the case had been put on the wrong track, and it was following a disturbingly predictable pattern. And that pattern usually leads to the non-indictment of the offending police officer. We, of course, I don't want to predict anything beyond that, but what I did note was the pattern that this case had been exhibiting, and the history of that kind of pattern, what it normally yields. The issue here for me is, well, of course, the community is going to do whatever the community is going to do. So I'm not really as concerned about that. What is concerning me more than anything else is the absolute total betrayal of the community by its so-called leadership. And here I'm very specifically referring to Al Sharpton, who has basically commandeered the situation and guided the situation through the appointment of lawyers. And while they now, you know, feverishly, they're calling news conferences to be ahead of what they believe is coming, and I won't be surprised about what is coming, but there isn't a single piece, there isn't a document anywhere in a court of law that says they were engaged in struggle here against the system. None of them. And I hope whatever happens, in whatever way it happens, the fact is this case is and has been on the wrong track from the beginning. And without the appropriate objections made officially, either by Sharpton or the high-priced attorneys who are working the case. That is what really, really disturbs me, because that too is a pathological pattern that the African-American and Latino communities particularly, who overwhelmingly go through this kind of experience, have been subjected to. And that, I am hoping that people start calling them out and publicly canceling whatever portfolios they appear to be carrying in behalf of the community as leaders. I hope we take a very, very hard look at that, because to me, again, the case from the very beginning, I'm not a lawyer, but I can tell you I am quite astute, I believe, in my analysis of what was going on in this case. I also refresh your memory that Alton Maddox, the only attorney in the United States who was successful twice in forcing the system to appoint a special prosecutor, has also agreed with the analysis and offered an incredible a template, really, in breaking the case down for us to understand what is going on in Ferguson. So the work that has to be done here is one of accountability, a blistering, no holds barred, public accountability of the key actors in this case. And the key actors are really not the prosecutor, as far as I'm concerned, not the prosecutor, not the governor. The key actors are the people who installed themselves as managers of this case and the authority people working in behalf of the not just the community of Ferguson, but the black community. We need to do some reappraisal of that publicly. Thank you so much. Joel from New York, you're on the air.
Hi, Yutrees. How are you doing?
Fine, thank you. How are you today?
I'm good. I'm very good. By the way, responding to Sarah's point about Veterans Day, you know, it used to be called Armistice Day, I believe, and it really was a celebration of the end of conflict, not the celebration of conflict itself. And the same thing is true of Independence Day. I mean, that was supposed to commemorate the independence of Great Britain, and it's been turned into a military valor day, so I thought I'd mention that. I wonder what people would think if someone like Professor Horn's account of the American Revolution were presented as, something that is part of a popular mythology. It might turn things around completely, don't you think? By the way, speaking of Dr. Horn, I thought I would comment on his presentation yesterday, if it's all right.
Sure, absolutely.
And, as usual, it was a really compelling narrative. And the strength, of his work, both his written work, some of which I've read, and there's so much, and his oral presentations, I think, is the power of the logic of his presentation, because he's always, presenting a thematic point of view, usually based on imperialism or racism, something like that. And it requires that you just develop your point and not just, make an assertion, and that he does. And he did it again yesterday. But there was one aspect of his presentation that I found a little confusing, and that is that, as you remember, he constantly made reference to the left and threaded it from his argument, if you recall. But there,
yes,
never really was a definition of really who he was talking about, because there were times when I thought he was really referring to the corporate left, that is to say, the liberal class, the liberal political class or the liberal elite. And there were, towards the end, there were times when I thought he was making intimations about the real left. So what I thought I would do today is to try to make that distinction a little bit clearly between the left and liberalism. Because, and I think I've said this before on your program, liberals don't really represent the left and never really have. They've been important for the left because they served as a funnel to bring very important radical and progressive ideas, whether it be the abolition of slavery or the rights of women or the rights of the workers, or even the ordinary civil rights that all of us demand and should have, bringing them into the mainstream of political life. That was the real function of liberalism until recently. But the problem with the left is that, just in terms of my own life, I remember that by the late 1950s, the left had virtually ceased to exist in American political life, and that this fateful eclipse of the left, due to a large extent to the Red Scare and the McCarthyite attacks of the late 40s and the 50s, but this fateful eclipse of the left was masked by the triumph of the liberals. And, you know, to draw a distinction between the left and the liberals may sound a little obscure, but it really isn't. And it's vital to do this, because if we make this distinction, we can understand American politics in our own age and begin to develop ideas about what we're going to have to do for the future. So when I say that the left had almost ceased to exist, I'm not really thinking of the socialist left exclusively. Although they had withered away, the last time we really saw anything that resembled that was in national politics, was Henry Wallace's Progressive Party, which ran in 1948 and did very badly. So what I mean by the left, in effect, is that it's any broad organized political force that holds as a principle the need for far-reaching social and institutional change, and consistently upholds the interests of the disadvantaged against the most powerful groups in society. And liberals were never such a force. And what I mean by liberals is that those who subscribe to the dominant ideology in the United States, which is, equating capitalism with democracy, an ideology that held that American capitalism was a revolutionary force for social change. It had its flaws, and it was the obligation and responsibility for governmental bodies to rectify those flaws through legislative action. And that once that was done, then we could go back and have economic growth, and that was supremely good because it obviated the need for redistributive politics, for the redistribution of wealth. And along with that, social conflict, which is, even if it's not violent, which is an absolute necessity if you're going to redistribute wealth, because the wealthy people aren't going to want to have it redistributed. And the idea that among the liberals then was that class really had no place in American politics. And not only are these not the ideas of the left, on a theoretical level, they actually provide a kind of sophisticated rationale for avoiding fundamental change. So in practice, liberals were almost always more concerned with distinguishing themselves from the left than about distinguishing themselves from conservatives. That's why when someone like Ralph Nader felt compelled to enter Parliament, Ralph Nader exemplifies, I guess, the spirit of American progressivism as much as anybody in our country. When he ran in 2000, it was the Democratic Party that really reacted most strongly against him. And I remember back in 72 when McGovern ran, and McGovern was a liberal, but he was really pushing the idea of liberalism towards radicalism. I remember the officials of the Democratic Party, especially the Democratic National Committee, walking away from him openly and supporting Nixon. And
I have to ask you a question here, mm-hmm. and that is, based on the definition that you offered, and I don't disagree at all, I think it's a fantastic definition of the left to distinguish that group from the liberal group, let's say. Okay, I go with that. Of the left that you know or have observed, which groups do you, are you sufficiently, are you comfortable with the left articulating what you also said is the purpose of the left, to lift up and to put at front and center this issue of race oppression? Do you see that as a normal part of the ideology of the left as it exists today?
Well, it should be the ideology of the left, but it should be. I'm sorry that I have to speak in the conditional sense, but my contention has been that an organized left does not exist in the United States. I mean, we have had left movements in the United States. We saw an explosion of left-wing consciousness starting around 1965. We saw it in African-American communities with the emergence of the Black Power movement moving slightly beyond the Civil Rights movement. We saw it with the anti-war movement emerging. But then it withered away, it dissipated. And that's because...
Well, this was Gerald's point, that the extent to which this is a commitment and a committed ideology and a committed position is the extent to which the African-American community has excited that recognition throughout the left. That was a point that he made, a very, very clear point, that it was African-Americans who departed from the norm, even from the left in the United States, and sought some kind of support for the various struggles that they were engaged in outside of the United States. That was the point that he was making.
I understand what he's saying there, but again, it seems to me that in order for any kind of political movement to be effective, it has to be organized. It has to be a broad, organized political force that holds forth to these principles that we all agree in, the principles of far-reaching social and institutional change and consistently upholding the interests of the disadvantaged. Now, that requires organization, and it requires a sense of knowing what you are about, of knowing what your objectives are. So it requires a political education of the entire population. It's not enough simply to say, to assert, you know, the right thing. We're talking about, you know, real action. And the problem that we're facing is that the confusion that exists in so many parts of American society, so many parts of American society might have been expected to hold out as the bastion of the left, became triumphs for the liberals. For instance, in order to have a coherent, massive, radical movement that calls for the kind of social change that we all want, you need organized labor abroad. You need the intelligentsia abroad. You need the universities. You need the liberal church. All of these were instruments for radical ideas, whatever they were. I remember, living in New York, Paul Moore, who was the head mm-hmm. of the Episcopal Church in New York, played a prominent role in the civil rights movement in New York. In fact, he refused to continue a building, you might remember this, St. John's, the great Gothic cathedral in the Upper mm-hmm. West Side of New York, as a protest against the degradation of the neighborhood surrounding it, things like that. And what has happened is that all of those groups that I just mentioned, organized labor has really been in decline for about 50 years, ever since the Fast-Hartley Act got rid of its radical. The CIO, Utrecht, Congress of Industrial Organization, before it merged with the AFL, in the 1940s, made a real push to organize African-American workers in the South. There were some 500,000 black union members south of the Mason-Dixon line. And they weren't just organizing them for in terms of benefits and salaries. They had a much deeper and broader social agenda that the people signed on to when they signed on. That's what I'm talking about when I talk about labor acting in interest, not only in their own self-interest, but acting in the interest of the public. And we've lost that. We've lost the progressivism that was part of organized labor. We've lost the progressivism that was associated with the intelligentsia. We've seen the universities become corporatized, and we've seen the liberal. Where is the liberal church in all of this? They were so manifest in the 1960s. Where are they now? All I hear is silence. So what we're seeing, I think, is a kind of retrogression, and the retrogression is due to the fact that, as I said, that the left has really not had much of a life over the last half century. And we really have to revive it. And we have to make a distinction, a real distinction, between the liberals who, want this kind of incremental change. But now we're faced with a political class where liberalism has no place anymore.
You're making fantastic points, and I agree. But I also say it's also their responsibility to make that distinction, and that's been my complaint.
Absolutely.
They've not taken on that responsibility the distinction at all.
Yeah, but again, I agree with you. I agree with you.
No. We agree with each other.
Except that I don't think that I think one of the reasons why nothing is why I think although I, actually I think there are one or two exceptions to that, Utrecht. So, I don't want to take up too much time, but I think there were one or two. And, I thought about them yesterday when Dr. Horn was speaking. So let me just quickly go over that. I mean, if you look at places like Richmond, California, or Seattle, Washington, or San Francisco, there were some extraordinary legislative victories that were won there. In Seattle, the establishment of a $15 an hour pay scale came because of the work that the Green Party did together with the socialists in Seattle. In Richmond, California, you might know that Exxon and Chevron tried to elect a mayor that poured millions of dollars into the mayoralty campaign and city council campaign because the big issue there was the attempt on the part of progressives throughout the city to prevent crude oil coming in from the outside to be refined, because there were huge refineries in Richmond, and they won. In San Francisco, there was also a coalition of progressives and Green Party in San Francisco to push for, and they succeeded in getting a $15 an hour wage law there. And of course, that it was styled in both in San Francisco and Seattle as absolutely necessary for people who are impoverished, especially people of color. So these are the kinds of things that can be done to begin to build up a new radical progressive culture that we need. But we've got to do it quickly, and it has to be done in conjunction with political education. My fear about what is happening now that we're living in this culture of inverted totalitarianism, where power is projected outward and also projected inward, my fear is that we are living in a society where people, and this is your fear too, where we become dormant, where we become inert and incapable of acting. And that's because of the manifest culture that we have to contend with. But once, I think the only point I really wanted to make today was to make this distinction between the left and the liberals, and to argue that we need to revive the left, and we can be angry at, you know, different groups on the left for acting either hypocritically. Well, by the way, I don't think there is, if we make these distinctions, we will realize that there is no one on the left who, for instance, supported the Ukrainian massacres that are going on. It's the liberals that are doing that. And that's one of the reasons why liberalism has become so degraded, because they have openly accepted this neoliberal, militarized, you know, policy that all of these governments follow. I don't think anybody who's really on the left would do that. Now, someone like Bernie Sanders or someone like the senator from Massachusetts, those kinds of people take positions that we can take, you know, real exception to. For instance, Bernie Sanders, who was a fine municipal socialist when he ran Burlington as a mayor, is now an open supporter of military adventurism. And so is the junior senator from Massachusetts. They are not really of the left. They are liberals. You see what I'm saying?
I get it. I got it. Thank you so much. You made a very strong point today.
Okay.
A series of very strong points. Thank you.
Bye-bye.
Thank you. From Los Angeles, DX, you're on the air.
Hello, Yutrif. How are you today?
Fine, thank you. What have you to say?
And hello to all the wonderful, brilliant listeners out there. I think you have the most brilliant listeners on planet Earth.
Me too. I think so, too.
And thank you for giving all of us an opportunity to free our mind on Fridays.
Well, you're going to be the last person, so and I'm so sorry, but we have to ask you to be pretty tight.
Okay, I will. I'll speed it up. Well, actually, the last call took a little bit of my thunder. I was going to say that we do have some victories out here on the West Coast. Not only did San Francisco pass a minimum wage, I believe it was $15.15, but also Oakland as well passed a minimum wage that wasn't as high as that. But at least, but that only bears out my philosophy that I've said a lot of times, that you have to act locally. You can think globally, but act locally. And as far as federal politics, I think we're pretty much done. There's nothing we can do really. I wanted to get something out there that I forgot last week when I called. It's a very helpful thing for people. On the situation in Ferguson, the young people there refuse to be co-opted or corrupted, and they have in fact told all the reverends and imams and anybody who's come in there, including political leaders, to just get lost. And I think we need to draw off the young people's energy, just as it was in the 60s. It was mostly young people out there defying the system, and even the people on the left who were telling them to just behave, they ignored them, they went against them, and that's what's happening now in Ferguson. And I think we need to use that as a jumping-off point, and maybe it'll really be one this time. I wanted to tell about an app. Everybody out there who has a Android phone, there's an app called Mobile Justice that was actually developed by people working with the ACLU, and they've released it in several states, including Oregon, California, Mississippi, Missouri. And, of course, there are different state laws and city ordinances about your involvement with the police, but here's what the app does.
I did talk about that on the show, actually.
Okay. Well, it lets you track police activity in your area and tells you what your rights are and what your responsibilities are as far as dealing with the police, and then people go out and basically stare at the police, make sure they're acting correctly, lawfully, and videotape them. So that app is called Mobile Justice, and if you have an Android phone and you're in one of those states, I understand it's coming to more and more states, but actually we should go download that. So, you know, that's what I wanted to say about that. Now,
thank you.
Do we have a few more minutes? Or?
You have about 1 minute or two.
Okay.
At most.
All right. Well, just to sum up the situation politically and with the election, I hear a lot of people, some people even on the left, even one or two people on this station, and I won't name any names, but I'll be nice. But we have to understand that people are going around saying that this election where the Democrats got trounced is not Obama's fault. Obama's doing this and that. That election was about result. You can't continue to promise things, and then when you get reelected or elected, then you don't do a dang thing for the people. People are starting to get smarter than that. That election was about results you didn't produce, so we're not going to reward you. That's what that was about. Unfortunately, with default parties, that only benefited the Republicans. But that's what that election was about. So thank you, Eutrice, and you have a wonderful day. I know you have to end the show now.
Thank you so much, DX, for being a superb manager of time. Thank you so much. And that brings us to the end of our program today. I enjoyed the various points of view offered for our consideration and hopefully for future discussion and debate. Thank you for always being on point. I really appreciate that. Stay tuned. Coming up next is Wake Up Call with Richard Martin. And you certainly can reach me at leadstories@gmail.com, leadstories@gmail.com, or on Facebook, Lead Stories with Eutrice Lead. I also want to mention that the Reverend Edward Pinckney has asked that we pass along his appreciation for those of you who were concerned about his fate as it, he's facing possible serious sentence of life. They've been threatening. I don't know that that would apply, but it has been raised by the prosecutor, so these things have to be taken seriously. If you wish to support him, it's B as in boy, H as in ham, Boy Ham Banco, BANCO, bhbanco.org. Have a great weekend. Make sure you take some time to just decelerate, devote yourself to having an enjoyable time, something pleasant. Connect with people who uplift you and support you and wish good things for you. And we'll see each other Monday, God willing, and the creek don't rise. Until then, please know from me what a joy and an exquisite privilege it is to be in your company. Bye-bye.
One more time, move on. You got to move on me, baby. Oh, you gotta move. I hate to let you go, baby, but oh, you got to move.